KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Sometimes you'll hear the term obsessive compulsive disorder tossed around casually. You may say it about yourself because you like to keep your car clean or you have the impulse from time to time to jump off a high place. But fastidious rituals or intrusive thoughts are normal. Pretty much all of us have them. The science writer David Adams says if you think you're a little bit OCD, you're probably not. You may have the O, he says, in the C, but it's the D that matters, the disorder part. That's the part that completely disrupts your life. He knows this because he has it. And as irrational as it may sound, Adam is terrified he's going to get AIDS. Today in the program, David Adam will join us to explain what OCD is, how it works, and its effect on his own life and the lives of others. Join us after the news. This week on Video West, a beautiful, sad story of a Mormon missionary who did what you're not supposed to do when you're out there. He fell in love, and he had to make that impossible choice, his faith or his heart. It's called Elder. In our favorite section this week, see a lovely piece produced by Jonathan Goldstein at the CBC. Goldstein is ending his great radio program, Wiretap, and in this short, you hear advice on what it means to age gracefully. Go watch at videowest.kuer.org. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. David Adams says it's hard to communicate how obsessive-compulsive disorder works, though that's what he does in his book. It's hard enough explaining obsession, how a single notion can dominate someone's mind for days and days and weeks, years even. Here's the best description he's come up with in the book. Think about a personal computer with different windows and operations, and you can open them, you can make them big or small, you could toggle between them. But he says that's how your mind usually handles thoughts. Obsession, though, real obsession, that's something else. That he describes as a large window that you can't get rid of. You can't move it. You can't force quit. You can't turn the machine off and on. Adam knows this because he has OCD. And in his book, he comes out. He goes public with this affliction. He also happens to be a science writer, so his book is a way of helping people understand OCD, how it works, where it comes from, but also what we can learn from these strange and obsessive thoughts that we, by the way, all have. The book is called The Man Who Couldn't Stop, OCD and the True Story of a Life Lost in Thought. David Adam is joining us today to talk about it. David Adam, as I said, is a science journalist, a writer, an editor for the journal Nature. Before that, he was a correspondent for The Guardian. He's joining us today from the studios of the BBC in London. And David Adam, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hello. Thank you.
Well, I guess we should start with the personal part, because you explain in the book, writing this book was because you didn't want to be selfish anymore. I mean, you have two kids now. They need you. And I guess that was a first step for you in some way.
Yeah, I think so. I think I don't think everybody agrees. Certainly, not everybody with OCD would agree that it's selfish. But that's how I felt, because I always felt that my attention was turned inwards, and every conversation that I had with somebody, I was second guessing what I was saying, and you feel very much as almost as if you're a fraud. Or I did anyway. When the kids came along, and I, partly because I started to involve them in the OCD, and we can get onto that if you like, but also because I knew I had a responsibility now, that I wasn't the most important person in my life, and I had to do what I could to sort it out.
Well, we should explain that your version of OCD, the obsession that you have, it's an incident that really got you started, and you explain this in the book. This was, I think it was in 1990 in college. You went out with this young woman, had a date, and the question came up in banter with a friend afterward, you know, did you have sex? And then did you use a condom? And your friend then suggested you could have AIDS. Would you explain that part of it? Because I'm wondering, was that like the trigger moment for this? And how does it work for you, or did it work for you in that sense?
Well, so I grew up in the 80s, and anyone who did so will remember the adverts, the public information films, because HIV and AIDS at the time was this great unknown. You know, they didn't really understand what it was, where it came from, how it was transmitted. And so the one weapon that the authorities had was to scare people, to try and get them to change their behaviour. Now, I was 14 or 15 at the time, and then a few years later, I met this girl, and the friend said to me the next day, "Did you have sex with her?" Now, I didn't have sex with her, but I lied, you know, to impress my friend. I said, "Oh, yeah." And then he said, "Did you use a condom?" And I said, "No." And then he said, "Oh, you could have AIDS." And even though I hadn't had sex with her, the fact that he said to me I could have AIDS just, I think, planted a seed. And then a few months later, that seed just sort of grew into this horrible obsessive plan that tangled up into my head. And I still hadn't had sex with this girl, and yet I just had this idea, this thought that I could have AIDS. And however irrational that sounds, and believe me, I know it sounds irrational, I just couldn't shake it. And that's such a strange and distressing experience. And I think that is that's the thought that I could not get rid of, which then prompted me to try and seek reassurance, to treat that thought rationally almost, and to give it respect and to make it legitimate. And in doing so, you reinforce the thought, and that's why people with OCD get locked into this cycle. But at its heart, it's a completely irrational thought.
There was this experience that you had. Your daughter, she was only 6 months old at the time, and you saw a little smear of blood on her leg. Now, before that time, you say that you kind of reconciled yourself to this idea that OCD was kind of your thing. This is my thing. But something about that experience with your daughter seemed to change things. This seemed like an important turning point, because this is how you put it in the book. You say, "Now I had made my daughter an accomplice." Would you explain that?
Yeah, so, I mean, absolutely was a turning point, but there's about 20 years between the two stories, you know, during which time I was pretty miserable, frankly. And as you say, by the end of that, I got to the point where I just thought, well, this is my life now. You know, I have OCD. I am someone who has OCD, and I have to accept that. And, you know, I could still function. I had a job, and I'd been married. I got married. You know, I could still do things. I just was thinking about HIV for most of the time and being anxious about it. But yeah, when I had my daughter and I saw this blood on her leg, then I found that, because that was one of the fears that I had, that I might catch HIV from smears of blood that I saw everywhere. It wasn't just about sex; it was about pretty much every possible method of transmission you could imagine, and I did imagine most of them. When I started to think about her being infected, and I found myself trying to reassure myself that she hadn't been by checking where she put her hands and checking it was in a playground, whether there was blood on the swing, had she picked up someone else's blood from me putting it in and out of the swing. So I would put it in and out of the swing about 10 times to try and see where she put her hands and to try and reassure myself that she had not contracted HIV in this way. And that's when I just stopped and looked at myself, and I just thought, what on earth are you doing? Because I was willing to sort of to screw up my own life almost, but I thought, I cannot do anything that's going to make her more likely to go through the same thing. You know what kids are like, they copy you, they ask questions. I thought, I cannot do this to her. It was bad enough first time around. I couldn't bear to watch her to do it, and anything that I can do that makes that less likely, I have to do, and that involved trying to get myself sorted out. So yeah, I rang the doctor the next day, and so began my recovery.
Right. You mentioned in the book that when people heard that you were writing about all of this, they figured it was kind of because you wanted to tackle, you know, the prejudice that's involved or raise awareness in particular. But you say, in fact, that wasn't the case for you, that at first you thought awareness was kind of, you know, vague or nebulous to address directly. But then you say you kind of were wrong about that. Talk a little bit about that part, because you do write about how OCD is portrayed in popular culture, how it gets a pretty raw deal, is how you put it, in the media, for example.
Yeah, so I think people attribute very noble motives to anybody who talks about their mental illnesses, because it's seen as a risky thing to do, and certainly an unusual thing to do. And so that's why I think people said to me, oh, you know, you're doing this to raise awareness or to help other people. And I suppose that was at the back of my mind, but it wasn't really that, because I'm a journalist, and I just thought this is a terrific story, because when I started to feel a bit better after I had the treatment and I started to think about OCD as a journalist rather than as a patient, I wanted to know more about it. Just to satisfy my own curiosity. And the more that I researched it and looked into it, I just became convinced that there was this terrific story that hadn't really been told. And it was only really in researching that story that I met people who had a far worse experience of OCD than I had. You know, people who had been suspended from their job, or people who had lost their families, or people who had surgery to try and make these thoughts go away. And I realised actually I was quite lucky, because when I did go for help, I managed to get good help. And lots of people can't do that even. And so that was when I started to realise that one of the barriers to people going to get help is this common misconception that OCD is just a funny behavioural quirk and therefore harmless. Because that's the message that people with OCD receive as well. And so they think, well, if that's OCD, what on earth is wrong with me?
Right.
Because I have these dreadful thoughts about harming people or HIV or whatever it is. I don't line up my DVDs. And so I know that OCD can be treated, but I don't have OCD because that's what the world tells me OCD is, and it's not what I've got. And, you know, and I really did meet people who went to their GP, and the GP just said, well, said nothing. GP is the doctor, the physician. Yeah. And they would be told, oh, you know, nothing to worry about, is it? We all have our little rituals. You know, and these are people who couldn't leave the house,
right,
because they were anxious about obsessive thoughts and the way that they responded to them. And so it has a real damaging effect. And it was only really afterwards that I started to appreciate just how... I think it was however much I had a miserable time of it, there are people out there who have it an awful lot worse. And part of the reason for that is this societal misunderstanding.
The way you've... I've heard you describe what it is, as like when people say, and you hear this all the time, I'm a little OCD about that. I like to keep my car clean, or I really like to, as you say, get the DVD straight. And when they say that, I'm a little bit OCD, you hear something else that you're probably not. You've got this, the O part, and you've got the C part, but it's the D part that's kind of the clincher in the scheme of things.
Yeah, I mean, it is possible to be a little bit OCD, because OCD is a spectrum.
Right.
And I still have OCD, but I don't have it as severely as I did 3 or 4 years ago. And there are certainly people who have it worse than others. So it is possible. But that is OCD. As you say, the obsession and the compulsions have to combine to cause distress and dysfunction and disorder. And there is a line at which we say, society says, okay, you strayed over the line into a disorder. In the same way as we might measure blood pressure and say at a certain point it's too high, that's now hypertension. So what people mean when they say they have, or what people usually mean when they say they have a little bit OCD, is they have a little bit of one or the other. But it's quite actually, it's quite difficult to have genuine a little bit of OCD. It's a bit like being a little bit pregnant, because you've passed a threshold and you've got to the point where you really need help.
Yeah.
You know, you're causing yourself great distress. You're having a significant impact on the quality of your life. And most people who say they're a little bit OCD actually take pride in it. You know, they see it as a good thing.
Right.
You even get people saying, oh, you know, I wish my wife was a bit more OCD, then she'd do the washing up or whatever. And if you actually knew what you were talking about, you would never wish that on anybody.
Right.
But equally, we shouldn't pretend that people with OCD are completely different to anybody else, because, as I said, it is a spectrum. But there is a point at which it becomes a disorder, and that is, frankly, the point at which someone knows that they need help.
It wasn't that long ago that it was believed OCD was extremely rare, but it turns out it's really not. I mean, you mentioned it's twice as common, for example, as autism and schizophrenia.
Yeah. I think it's partly because it's quite easy to hide OCD. It's not very easy to hide autism, and autism tends to be diagnosed in children. Schizophrenia, it can be quite difficult to hide. With OCD, because almost all of the real severe distress comes from the thoughts and the anxiety that the thoughts produce, it's not visible. Unless people choose to talk about it. Now, there are some people who quite often the compulsions, the behaviours which come with the thoughts can be very extreme. So there are people who need to wash their hands all the time and their hands are red raw. There are people who have an obsessive need to or a compulsive desire to flick light switches on a set number of times, or to check the door is locked a set number of times. And those can be quite difficult to hide. But in my case, nobody knew, because I had these internal anxieties about HIV, and I would find ways in my own time to try and reassure myself. So I would go and give blood, so I would have a test. I would call, there was a National AIDS helpline back in the 90s that you could call, and I would ask them questions about things that had happened to me, waiting for them to say, no, you don't have AIDS. And so nobody knew about my OCD unless I told them. And I think that's the case with a lot of people with OCD.
I wonder, you mentioned that it affects men and women equally, that it falls over the range of ethnic geographical boundaries. And this also, you point out, 2/3 never actually see a mental health professional.
Yeah. Well, so it's, I think, you know, there's quite good evidence that it has been, it's been around as long as we've been keeping records. You know, for as long as people have been writing down the human experience, these obsessive, intrusive thoughts have been recorded, and extreme reactions and behaviours as a response to them have been recorded. So the explanation for those has shifted with our understanding and belief. So Middle Ages, it was very much a religious context, and these kind of thoughts were down to evil spirits. Mm-hmm. And then in Freudian thinking, it was all about repression of unwanted desires. And then right through the 20th century, as sort of science evolved, so the explanations for OCD evolved. So, you know, the behavioural psychologists thought that it was all about there was some kind of external trigger that people were responding to. And it was only really in the 1980s that the cognitive psychologists started to think, well, what about these thoughts that everybody has? Maybe that's the reason. Maybe we should look at why those thoughts get stuck in some people. And I think the reason that most people never get any help is partly because they didn't know help was out there.
Right.
And for a lot of the time, there wasn't help out there. You know, there was no reliable treatment, really, until the 80s, 90s. Even when I went to get... The first time I went to see a psychiatrist was in the mid-90s. And he gave me an elastic band, a rubber band, to put on my wrist and snap against my wrist every time I had an intrusive thought about HIV. So that's only 20 years ago. And you can imagine that if people try and get help and then they get rebuffed or told there isn't any help or they get something that doesn't work, then you think, well, I've tried that, so I'm just going to have to live with it.
I want to talk more about these thoughts and how they work, which you explore in your book, when we get back from the break. David Adam is with us. His book is called The Man Who Couldn't Stop, OCD and the True Story of a Life Lost in Thought. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. You ever have the urge to jump in front of a train or drive into oncoming traffic? Do you ever stress out about whether you left the oven on or the door unlocked? Well, a lot of us have those thoughts. David Adam says the average person has about 4,000 thoughts a day, and most of us can shake off the stranger ones. A person with obsessive compulsive disorder can't. They can't let an idea go. They're obsessed with it. David Adam has written a book about OCD. It's called The Man Who Couldn't Stop, OCD and the True Story of a Life Lost in Thought. He's joining us from the studios of the BBC in London to talk about it. So let's talk about those intrusive thoughts that you say we all have. We all have various types of them. Some of them are shocking and strange. And you describe the difference between certain thoughts. Some you describe as ego-syntonic, but then there's the ego-dystonic. Give us a sense of the difference between these intrusive thoughts in our minds.
So they're both bad thoughts, if you like. They're both thoughts that can cause people anxiety and distress. But one is a type of thought which it seems normal to have them, or even a positive thing to have them. For example, if you are anxious about a job interview, for example, you might have negative thoughts about, if I don't get this job, then I'm not going to be able to feed the family.
Right.
Now, that actually chimes with the fact that you want to be the kind of person who would be able to feed your family. So although those thoughts are distressing to you, they aren't out of tune with the kind of person that you want to be and you want others to perceive you as. Another example is, you know, I want to be able to pass my driving test so I can get to work, because, again, you know, you want that money, you want that status, you want people to think you're the kind of person who is able to drive. That's a good thing. But then there are the ego-dystonic thoughts, and those are more easily described as just the kind of thoughts that make people go, whoa, why did I think that?
Yeah.
And these are the thoughts that not only is the content of the thought distressing, but just to have the thought itself is distressing. You're standing in the kitchen holding a knife, and there's someone else next to you, and you think, oh, I could just stab them in the back with this knife. I had one yesterday. I was holding my three-year-old son, showing him the view from the top of a multi-story car park, and I just thought, oh, wouldn't it be easy just to throw him over? And it's horrific to even consider that kind of a thought. And so not only do those kind of thoughts cause the anxiety and the distress, but they also make us question who we are, because they clash with the kind of person we want to be.
Right.
And this is what psychologists call intrusive thoughts. So these are the thoughts that you think have no place in your mind. So these are the thoughts to jump in front of a train. to leap from a high building. Even, I don't know, I find sometimes when I'm holding an expensive camera, taking a view, I just want to throw it into the river. You know, it's bizarre. And then, depending on what kind of person you are, sometimes those thoughts resonate. And that's one of the explanations for why, although most people, almost everybody, has these intrusive thoughts, only some of those people turn them into obsessive-compulsive disorder.
You write about, you know, this question of where these thoughts come from. And it turns out that we don't really have a very good answer, it seems. But there is this theory that you write about that our brains have this thing called a cognitive idea generator, which, and the idea is, this kind of gets us into this idea of how we've evolved to have certain thoughts, because it's designed to help us solve problems. But I guess the idea is that sometimes it kind of, as you put it in the book, it can spin out of control.
Yeah, I mean, it's speculation, because it turns out it's actually very difficult to track thoughts in the mind and the brain. But there is an idea that it's a bit like unconscious brainstorming. I guess quite literally brainstorming. But you know the kind of exercise that people do in companies sometimes, where everyone has an idea and they all write them on a sticky note, and you know no idea is off the table. Let's consider everything, however outlandish it might seem, because that's the way one way of being creative, I suppose, and finding a solution to a problem. So the idea is that our brains do a similar thing, and that we are constantly unconsciously reacting to stimulus. And some of those thoughts, these ideas, which are just being generated by the unconscious, are pretty unpleasant. Mm. For example, if you walk along the street and there's an old lady in front of you eating a sandwich and you're hungry, then one of the ways that your mind is going to be telling you to deal with your hunger is to steal that sandwich from the old lady.
Right.
Because now, you would never do that, but clearly it is one of the solutions to the problem of being hungry. And most of the time, these thoughts are in the subconscious. We're not even aware of them. But sometimes, the theory says, sometimes one of these thoughts might bubble up to the surface and actually enters the consciousness. And when it's one of these thoughts which is quite distressing, then it makes us, as I said, go, whoa. But not all of them are. You know, there are many positive thoughts that just can come as random ideas into the head, you know, from Paul McCartney and the Beatles to Mozart, mm-hmm. Beethoven. People have always talked about how some of their best work just came to them fully formed. And so it's not the generation of these thoughts which is the problem, but it's the way the more negative ones can be received.
Well, you also write about how some of these intrusive thoughts, when you try to force them to go away, you know, to think about something else, that becomes kind of impossible. Because, and you say it's not really a good idea to try and do that, because that's where the problem begins. This is where the so-called white bear effect comes
so
up.
So you cannot. Yeah, you cannot outthink a thought. You know, you cannot rationalize away an irrational thought. And what happens is, when you have these thoughts, as I did, which you know are wrong, because as we've said, they're ego dystonic, they clash with the kind of person we are, they cause distress, and they don't go away, then one of the ways that it's a very natural response is to try and force them to go away, to suppress them. You know, people say, don't even think about it, or don't give it a second thought. Well, that's really difficult.
Yeah.
Because if I say to you now, don't think of an elephant, then what's the first thing that you think of?
Right.
And the white bear effect was because this was done. Some psychologists in the 60s and 70s took some students, and they separated them into two groups. And one group, they said to them, right, don't think of a white bear, of a polar bear. And they found that asking people to suppress these thoughts not only was that very difficult, if not impossible. But after you stopped trying to suppress it, the thoughts came more often. So just the act of trying not to think about something makes you think about it more. And this is a sort of quirk of the human mind, which people have used to explain all sorts of strange experiences. For example, you know, people who are on a diet, all they can think about is cake
yeah.
and donuts because they're trying hard not to. And they've shown in studies that the people who are trying to give up smoking, the people who really want to give up smoking the most, are the most motivated to do so, find it the hardest. Mm. And one explanation for that is that the more they try not to think about their cigarette craving, the more they crave these cigarettes. Mm. And so in obsessive compulsive disorder, what happens is that if you try and suppress these bad thoughts, like, oh, I mustn't think about throwing my 3-year-old off the roof because that's a really bad thing and I don't want to be a bad person, I mustn't think about it, you just think about it more and you make the situation worse.
There's a great section in your book where you write about how, in some ways, this is what great athletes seem to be able to do, and that is not think too much about, you know, about their movement and their performance while they're doing it. And you write about the techniques that some sports psychologists are coming up with to distract people, to get them to, what, I guess, just sort of behave in a way where you're not thinking about it too much. One of them is this man named Jürgen Beckmann. I really liked this part in the book. We talk about this section, this part.
Yeah, so this is, so if you can't suppress thought, you can't make them go away, how do they go away? Well, one of the ways is you get distracted by something else. Now, it's quite difficult to deliberately distract yourself, but it is possible to give the mind something else to do, to focus on. Mm-hmm. And so this was a guy who worked with the German alpine ski team in the early 90s. And he noticed, the coach noticed, that there was a couple of skiers who, they were very good in the turns. They were very quick, you know, very close to the snow. But on the glide, the bit when, to you and I who don't ski, it looks the most terrifying bit because they're just careering down the mountain without any control. To a skier, those bits, to a really good skier, those bits are actually a bit boring because they're not doing anything. Yeah. And these skiers would find that in the glide, as they call it, their mind would start to wander. And they start to think about things. And what they'd usually think about was, well, how can I go even faster? And so they would sort of tighten their legs and try and go faster. And in doing so, they would slow themselves down because they hit all those little bumps a little bit harder. And so the coach said, right, well, we need a way to stop you thinking about how to ski faster. So here's what you need to do. When you're in the glide, start counting backwards from 999 in threes.
Right.
And bizarrely, it seemed to help, because as these German skiers did this, their times improved. And one of them actually went on to win a gold medal in the Winter Olympics. Now, of course, that isn't the only reason that they won the gold medal, or they're a very good skier. And we all have good days and bad days. But the coach became convinced that it worked, because you could take away, or you could give the mind something else to think about, so you didn't allow these thoughts to come from nowhere and make you focus on something else. Now, the problem with distraction, and I've had this, you know, when I was in the worst of my OCD, there were a few things that really helped, and those were almost always things that distracted my attention completely. So playing soccer was one for me, and also weirdly public speaking. You know, I'm now talking to countless people live, and to most people that would be terrifying, but I've always enjoyed it, because while I'm talking to you now, I can't think about HIV and AIDS, because if I stop talking, I'm gonna sound like a fool. So it really focuses me. But of course you can't distract yourself forever, but right. you always have downtime, and that's when these intrusive thoughts of HIV in my case come back.
Right. You ask in the book, so if almost everyone experiences intrusive thoughts, and if then intrusive thoughts are the raw materials for obsessions, then why doesn't everyone develop OCD? And in the book, you kind of break this down, which involves exploring, you know, how different minds process the same thought in very different ways. And one of the things that's interesting about this is you say that this is where religion comes into play. At least one of the first places that the researchers started exploring that aspect was religion. You have a chapter called The God Obsession where you explore this. Talk about this part.
So I have to be quite careful what I say. I'm not saying that religion is a form of OCD in any way.
And you're very clear about that, by the way. That religion is not a mental illness, that OCD and religious beliefs are not the same thing. I mean, you make that very clear in the book, too.
Right. But there does seem to be some evidence that patterns of thinking or types of thinking that can make people very religious can also, in other people, or indeed sometimes the same people, produce sort of obsessive compulsive symptoms. And one explanation for that is there is a what psychologists call a dysfunctional belief called thought action fusion, and that basically means that that someone who has a thought, to them having that thought is the same as doing what the thought suggests. So if I have that thought about throwing my three-year-old off the roof, to them, just to have that thought means that they're effectively a murderer.
Right.
Because to think it is the same as to do it. And you do get this in some religions, and in fact, in the Bible. So the Sermon on the Mount,
right.
Jesus Christ says, adultery in the mind is as bad as in the flesh. You know, to think about having sex is as bad as to do it. One of the Ten Commandments is, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's ox. So even to think about wanting something is a sin equivalent to killing somebody. Now, in OCD, the way this can manifest itself is because if I was to say to you, to the listeners now, everybody should take out a piece of paper and write down on it, think of someone who you love more than anyone else in the world, and write down on it, or say out loud even, my parents are going to die in a car crash, or my sister, or my husband, or whoever it is. Lots of people cannot do that. They just cannot do it. You ask them to do it, and they will not do it. And the reason they won't do it is because they think saying it makes it more likely to happen.
Right.
And someone with OCD takes it to the extreme that if they say it, they then have to undo it somehow. So they have to say, oh, not really, or just joking, or they tap the table three times to sort of undo the thought. And that is one way of interpreting these thoughts that we all have in a way that can then lead to obsessive compulsive disorder. But it can also explain why some people who have OCD can... It can manifest itself through religious obsessions. And so, for example, if you are constantly being told that you must have a pure mind, that you mustn't think about doing sinful things, then to have those thoughts, which everybody does, can be very distressing to you because it challenges your sense of who you are as a good religious person. In fact, there's a very sort of specialist form of OCD called scrupulosity, which is exactly this, which is people who are very religious, very devout, and yet have these doubts or these thoughts or these impulses, which to them are horrific and blasphemous. Now, everybody has horrific thoughts, but to them, because they are so, to them, their religion is so important to them, to have thoughts that challenge that indicates to them that they are sinful, that they are not as devout as they thought. And that can be hugely distressing. And we know this has gone right back to the very early days. Martin Luther, people like that would describe these thoughts, like they had these thoughts to worship the devil. And they would actually attribute it to the devil. And they would say, you know, this shows that I'm not as pure as I thought I was, and that I must try harder to be pure. I must banish these thoughts from my mind. And you get this a lot with different types of religion. So with sort of Protestant Christians, because it is about purity of thought, people are very distressed when they find that their thoughts aren't as pure as they want them to be.
Right.
But then with, say, the Islamic faith, which is much more about ritual and order and doing things, you know, praying a set number of times in a set direction or performing rituals, they can start to have intrusive thoughts about, well, did I do that 3 times or 4 times? I better do it again just to make sure. And so religion can be an outlet for these kind of obsessions, in the same way as, in my case, it was HIV.
Mm. David Adam is with us. His book is The Man Who Couldn't Stop, OCD and the True Story of a Life Lost in Thought. We'll take another quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the science journalist David Adam. We're talking about his book, The Man Who Couldn't Stop, OCD and the True Story of a Life Lost in Thought. He's joining us from the studios at the BBC in London. You write about, you say this in the book, that there's something animal about OCD, something primitive and atavistic. And you write about how animals have obsessive behaviors, you know, dogs chasing their tails and mice pulling their hair and all of those kinds of things. But there's a difference between a ritual and a compulsive disorder. And you explain how an animal does these things as a survival mechanism. And I wanted you to talk a little bit more about that. Like, what's the relationship between OCD traits and our impulse for survival, for example?
It's a good question, and it's a big topic. Of course, animals show a behavior, but we don't know what it is, if anything, they're thinking.
Right.
So that is one key difference. In humans, obsessive compulsive disorder is a compulsive response to these irrational thoughts. But what we do know with some animals is that they show behaviors which look like they are compulsive. They look like they have to do these things, and they can't switch them off, even though they want to, because the dog that chases its tail, for example, although that's it's a staple of, you know, cartoons and seen as a harmless, funny thing for the dog to do, actually lots of dogs, they don't just chase their own tails, they catch their own tails and they bite them until they bleed. So they're causing damage to themselves through this either a ritualistic behavior or a compulsive behavior or repetitive behavior, however you want to characterize it. And what's quite interesting is that the themes for some of these stereotypical behaviors in animals can be traced back to the same themes that OCD tends to divide along. So grooming is one. Mm. You know, lots of people with OCD wash their hands as a behavioral response to a distressing thought. Now, that thought doesn't have to be that their hands are dirty. It could be anything. It's just that washing hands seems to provide comfort.
You had this for a time.
Yeah, I did. But mine was a response to, I thought that I had contamination on my hands.
Yeah.
If I had blood on my hands, for example, because I'd cut myself shaving or whatever, then I would wash my hands compulsively to try and avoid transferring HIV. But some people, although they have the behavior of the hand washing, the thought is something completely different. It can be, we described the thought about so-and-so is going to die in a car accident, and the way of making that not happen is to wash their hands. So it doesn't have to be that their hands might be dirty. But then an animal, if you put a deer next to a lion, you know, in extreme peril, one of the behavioral responses seems to be that it washes itself. So it responds to stress in this completely dysfunctional way. And there are other parallels as well. So mice sort of hoard round, shiny objects in this. And as you know, there's a human condition of hoarding. Mm-hmm. So, and scientists can take mice and by fiddling with the sort of the part of the brain which is also implicated in OCD in people, they can seem to make the mice develop compulsive rituals. And then they can make those rituals go away. And so the theory, and it is only a theory, is that there is some kind of sort of ritualistic behaviours which are hardwired into our brains and into the brains of the animals. This is what biologists call fixed action patterns. So I describe it in the book as being a bit like a dishwasher. You know, there are these set programs which are very easy to turn on and very difficult to turn off. So one of them is to wash. One of them is to run away. One of them is to make sure that your young are safe. And clearly, some of those would seem to have an evolutionary advantage. You know, if you're more concerned about hygiene and washing than somebody else, then, or you do that more often, then over time you probably are less likely to die of an infectious disease. And so one of the sort of evolutionary explanations for OCD is that way back in time it was useful to have this focus on these very specific sort of themes like hygiene, cleanliness, making sure that your family are safe, security. You could even attribute sort of a love of symmetry to this, because if you have an ordered environment to live in, then it's much easier to spot things that are out of place, like a lion. Now, it's very difficult to test these ideas, if not impossible, because, you know, this all happened zillions of years ago. And there's no way of recreating those conditions to see what happens. But we do certainly know that there are parallels to animals, and the same parts of the brain seem to be implicated, and even the same treatments seem to help. So one of the ways that they treat OCD is to give antidepressant drugs like Prozac. Right. If you give Prozac to an obsessive mouse, it stops being obsessive. So there are suggestions that that you can trace the origins of all of this way back to before we evolved into humans.
You raise the question of whether or not OCD is genetic. Can this be passed along? But there doesn't seem to be a one single obsession gene, for example. You point out it's a lot more complicated than that. Genes work alongside other genes. And this is interesting. I mean, you say that mental disorders that run in families don't necessarily need to have a genetic cause, because, of course, you've got to plug into the equation the impact of the environment.
Well, exactly. So we do know that OCD runs in families. So most people, about a 1 in 40, 4-0 chance of getting OCD. If you have a family member who's affected, that goes up to about 1 in 10. And part of the reason for that could be that it is passed on in genes, but also the environment, the behaviour of your parents can be very important. One of the most famous cases of OCD is probably Howard Hughes. Leonardo DiCaprio played him in The Aviator. Mm-hmm. And by the end, Howard Hughes was desperately obsessed with hygiene and avoiding germs. And it turns out that Howard Hughes' mother was very anxious about polio and would go to great lengths to protect the young Howard Hughes from the disease. So you could see why that kind of behaviour in a parent might influence the child. Equally, there are people who would grow up in an environment like that and not develop OCD. So there does seem to be, the best guess is that genetics and environment are about equally responsible. And that even if as you say, we've started to probe the genetics of OCD by looking at families, and the genetic component, which does seem to be there, is a very complex one. So it's not like you can pinpoint it to two or three genes and say, you know, that's OCD on or off.
So do we, I guess if we're still trying to figure out how that all works, what do we understand about the events that trigger OCD, if that's the proper way even to put it? Because, I mean, bullying can bring it on. You mentioned accidents can bring it on. I'm guessing war or combat experiences, I'm sure something like it. What do we know about the triggers at this point?
Well, I think trigger is absolutely the right language to use. And in about half the people with OCD surveyed, when you ask people about OCD, about half of them can blame it on a particular trauma. Mm. So we know that OCD can come on after someone has had, has been bullied or has been sexually assaulted or had a physical accident, has had a bang on the head, or has caught a disease which inflames part of the brain. And so in some people, we think that it might be a response to that. But in others, there doesn't seem to be any explicit trauma anyway. And I think in my case, I guess I was frightened, but I didn't have something you would describe as a traumatic experience.
Right.
And so I think it's difficult, really. But I think one of the ideas that we're looking at is whether the response to trauma and how we do it. Because as I said, we do find, as humans, we find comfort in pattern and ritual. And it could be that it's a response to trauma, which then goes a bit haywire.
David Adam, his book is called The Man Who Couldn't Stop, OCD and the True Story of a Life Lost in Thought. He joined us from the studios of the BBC in London. David, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you. Thank you.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Susan Anderson and Braden Child. The show directed today by Bob Nelson. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.